average real interest rates were 2%.
Yeah.
So
people talk about low interest rates.
My point is that don't be fearful of a normalization of bond yields and interest rates.
Oh, because it's been the actually, best thing that's happened to my investment career.
We need to turn on the pod for this because this is
we're running.
But
what do we get started?
John and I mean, we again 2000 2010.
Mm-hmm.
The US virtually went sideways, which again is the bias. Mm. Our bias is actually UK equities can do as well as the US, but that was in a funny period.
Yeah,
where
it was a funny period.
Again,
it was a funny period. Yeah,
we need to get over it, John.
We'll talk about it. Yeah, because 2000 to 2003 was not a good period for the US as the dot-com bubble burst.
Good, well, we'll make a start, shall we?
Right,
good. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 27. Joined as always by James Hughes, investment manager, and thrilled to be joined by Alan McIntosh. A little biography here for him. Alan serves as the chief investment strategist and acting chief investment officer at Quilter Cheviot. His role encompasses several key responsibilities, including equity strategy, chairing the asset allocation committee, and sitting on various other sub-investment committees across the firm. Before joining Quilter Cheviot, Alan was a founding partner at Cheviot Asset Management, where he held the position of chief investment officer. His experience also includes roles at Lang & Cruickshank Investment Management and Credit Suisse Asset Management before that. Alan graduated with an honours degree in economics from Heriot Watt University, is a keen amateur astronomer and lover of 1970s prog rock.
Oh, yes.
Big fan of those.
Fantastic.
Very different from last week's cohort who wouldn't know what prog rock was, but
quite, I do.
Alan, welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Few more weeks and then setting off into the retirement sunset.
Yes. So 42 years of helping people make money in investments.
Yep.
And I think time to hang my boots up. And I have plenty of energy, but I'm not going to carry on helping the financial services sector. I will use that energy in a different direction.
Oh, good, good.
And you've finally seen Japan.
Yes, absolutely. I remember
that was the time to retire.
In 1989, when it hit its 39,000 and a bit on the Nikkei. And it's taken, 30 odd years to get back there.
Incredible.
Amazing.
Well, why don't we start off then, Alan? I was quite intrigued about your sort of early career in the 80s. Yeah. What did that look like, and what was your, like, you didn't have emails, I mean, this is
mind-blowing stuff.
Right? Telephones and faxes?
Yeah, and so our market information was a setup called Topic, which was provided by the Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And until 1984, when the FTSE 100 actually launched, I mean, you had the FT30, and you could scroll through the All Share Index. You could get some overseas data. But the interesting thing, so, you know, let's go back to the beginning. So I started my investment career in August 1982 as a trainee US fund manager at Scottish Life in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And it was one of these things, it was just good luck. I had a degree in economics, I was interested in investments. Dissertation was on efficient markets.
Was it?
And so I was already interested, although the first mistake I made when I went to my interview at Scottish Life, they said, you know, well, what have you been, why are you interested in investments? I said, well, I did a big project on efficient market hypothesis. And he said, what was the conclusion? I said, well, it's absolutely true, you can't pick stocks. And they said, so why are you here? I said, there is an extreme view that you can, and I kind of tried to talk my way out of that one, but I thought, oh, but first faux pas, so I'm not gonna pursue that route ever again.
This guy Jack Bogle, Vanguard.
Yeah. So that was interesting times because we'd only just basically been given the green light to invest overseas. If you cast your mind back to 1979, so. When Mrs. Thatcher was elected in 1979, one of the first things, I think it was Nigel Lawson as our Chancellor, was to remove exchange controls and the dollar premium. So previously you had to pay a premium to invest outside of the UK.
Right.
And so most investment departments were expanding their overseas. So we took on someone to cover Japan and someone else to cover the US. So I got the US. My friend, who was actually also on the same economics course, got the Japan job. So we were pretty chuffed that we both got
the job. Slightly luckier having the US and Japan, though, with the benefit of
hindsight. Well, absolutely. And so my initial... you know, kind of role was literally there were hundreds of companies coming through, US companies coming through Edinburgh, because they knew that suddenly they were tapping into a totally fresh investor base.
That was quite a big fund management community, wasn't it?
Edinburgh. Massive. Standard Life were the biggest. But so there were the life companies down at St. Andrew's Square, end of Prince's Street. And then the kind of the Baillie Giffords, the Martin Currys, the Charlotte Square, they were at the posh end. They were at the New Town end, and we were at the kind of slightly shabby end down heading towards Leith Docks, you know, so it's, but it was, and there was a bit of rivalry there, but it was fun times. But interesting, so when I started, there was actually a tech bubble going on in the US market. It was loads and loads of IPOs. It was nothing like the dot-com bubble, but it was a whole mini kind of tech thing. And it was more about chips, chip technology. But loads of companies came through town, and it was a great experience because you're just getting exposure to lots of really smart people. And then there were the conventional companies coming through. And I remember meeting, so a few of us kind of started, you know, kind of straight after graduation. And I met my counterpart who was working for Standard Life. We were at a lunch meeting company. And we're exchanging notes, and this was literally my kind of first or second week. And he said, you know, what are you guys buying at the moment? And I said, well, we're flipping some of these IPOs. But he said, yeah, but what about your mainstream portfolios? I said, well, we've been buying this discount retailer called Kmart. And he said, oh, right. And I said, what's the problem? He said, well, we're buying the mainstream discount retailer called Walmart. And so I went back and spoke to my boss, and I said, it was interesting. I was chatting to a new colleague, friend, and he kind of looked a bit snooty when he said, I said, we're buying Kmart, and there, and my boss, Ian McCallum, said, oh, no, everybody's buying Walmart. You know, we think this is the one that will really become, you know, the winner. 6 months later, went bankrupt. So the first lesson I learned was don't be too clever. You know, sometimes good quality businesses that have been around for a while, they're around for a while for a good reason, and they can compound. And Walmart, of course, went on to become, and still is, probably the biggest retailer.
Biggest retailer in the world.
In the world. So we were trying to be too cute by picking a company that actually could get totally thrashed.
It was probably two handles cheaper on a PE or something, or on a dividend yield was half a point higher. You know, so, and you thought, oh, we can buy this one because it's a discount.
And that informed me, and it made me think more about, well, trying to identify good companies and kind of holding on to them, which is something that, I mean, it's a kind of philosophy that we have at QC. You know, the team do try and have a kind of quality growth bias. Not to say there are opportunities elsewhere, but you know, if you want a kind of core portfolio that you can almost fit and forget, you know, those sorts quality, of names usually, you know, will pay off in the long term. So that was interesting. I suppose the next big event, which everyone talked about, was the October 87 crash. Which was quite interesting because, and again, great story there, because on that was October the 19th, Black Monday. So October the 16th, the previous Friday, there was a huge hurricane storm in the south of England. It wasn't in UK wide because it wasn't in Scotland.
That was the Michael Fish.
That's exactly, no storm, that's absolutely right. So when I went into work on the Friday morning, by that time I was heading up the UK desk at Scottish Life. So I couldn't get a hold of any brokers in London because
no one was at the desk.
Eventually, a few of them came wandering in. In the afternoon, Wall Street was off 3 or 4%. You know, there was no real hint of anything to come, and the UK market had closed down. But anyway, I was on a Friday evening. We always went for a drink about 5 o'clock, and I was still sitting at my desk about 5:30. My phone went, and it was one of my brokers from what was then Phillips and Drew, became UBS, and he said, "Look, I've just had a call from our US desk," and he said, "they can offer you $500,000 ICI." That was a company then in the FTSE. $500,000 ICI at 5% below the London close. And we had a load of cash flow coming in because at that time there was huge just allocations to equities.
These were pension funds,
and our life fund was also. They were, you know, boosting their equity.
Yeah.
The opposite.
I was going to say, there's a lesson there.
Total opposite of what's happening today. And so I had money to burn. So I said, okay, I'll take that. And then, of course, Monday came and the US market opened down and closed down 22%, which is the largest one-day fall. What I did, because we got a sense that the US market was going to open sharply lower. Mm. So the first thing I did was go on to my broker and said, "Can you cut that position now?" And I took a loss on it. I got a bit of a kicking from my boss. But lesson number two, never buy any stock last thing on a Friday evening, because you have no idea what can happen over the next 48 hours. Bad stuff can happen. And there was obviously a reason someone was dumping the stock at a discount to the London close. And people to this day don't really know what triggered the 87 crash. No. There was a flick up. What I do remember is the US was running twin deficits, budget deficit and trade deficit. And believe it or not, you'd laugh now, but they were both above 4% of GDP. Now that's normal, it's nothing. But it pushed bond yields up quite sharply. There must have been a bit of a buyer's strike at an auction on the Friday. And that move up in the bond yields was enough to trigger a correction. But the market had been on a tear earlier in the year. So it wasn't as if, ironically, even though that was a 20% fall, and the UK closed 10% down on the Friday afternoon, and then opened up another 10% down on the Monday. So it was down 20%, but spread over 2 days. It still closed up by the end of the year.
Because the market was up 40% into it, wasn't
it?
Exactly. And it's probably a good time. We've got, I didn't really know what charts to put up, so I just did a chart of MSCI World since the end of 79. So this is 44 years. So this kind of encapsulates most of your career.
It really does. And the one thing that struck me, Jonathan, when you showed me that chart yesterday, was if you look at the first 20 years, so the 80s and the 90s, how, well, the slope of that curve is
very steep.
Higher than the subsequent 20 years. And I did some checking, and over that 20-year period, the US stock market averaged just over 17% per annum.
That's an extraordinary number.
And that was a time when real interest rates averaged about 2%. They were obviously a lot higher than they were now. And inflation was certainly 2, 3%, volatile, higher at the beginning of the period and heading down as the period ended. But I think what I take comfort from is when everyone's worried about the new regime where interest rates look more similar to where we were pre-financial crisis, and real interest rates may be positive. So even if inflation gets down towards 2, you may see bond yields and short rates 3 or 4. Don't be fearful, because companies can adapt to that. And it's more about stability. So I'm not at all worried that we cannot get good returns from equities in that post-GFC world. What's been painful is the transition from zero rates to where we are now.
Yeah, they're saying that this morning. I mean, I was in a client meeting this morning, and if you sort of look at the peak in December 21 to basically today is 2 years.
Yeah.
And portfolios are sort of back, probably just above, sort of there or thereabouts to where they were 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, had you said to me during that period that inflation would round trip from 2 to 12, and interest rates are going from 0 to 5.5% and will still be there, I would have said the damage would have been a lot worse.
Absolutely. It's quite remarkable.
22 wasn't a great year by any stretch, but you put it in that sort of context and it's not been too bad. But
And it is beginning to fade you know, out of the numbers.
Yeah.
And, you know, it will still be a scar for people's memories for a few years because, you know, had they, this slightly unusual situation where both, you know, bonds and equities were poor stores of value.
Yeah.
But as I say, there's plenty of time to get that back.
But you're right, though. I mean, during that period, the 80s and the 90s, bond yields were well into kind of high single digits, weren't they? Even, you know, the dot-com, which we'll come on to talk about.
Yes.
During the speculative mania of dot-com, you could get 7% on a US Treasury.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not, you know, the 2020-2021 period of sort of bubble-like behaviour that we had in certain areas was in part driven by low rates. But actually, it wasn't, you know, you could kind of see how that might not be the case. But so when, I mean, what was your sort of recollections of the 90s then kind of leading into dot-com? And I guess the inevitable question is, any sort of similarities to where we stand today?
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Because there are similarities, but I don't think parallels.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that coming into the kind of dot-com bubble, and this was all about the internet, to be perfectly honest, and sure, there was a huge amount. Again, there was plenty of capital to be deployed. Markets were buoyant. People were, you know, feeling very optimistic. And, you know, it was really just a seller's market. You know, the stocks coming to IPO, that anything, you just called it something .com, and, you know, you expected to get a fantastic multiple.
Mm.
I think the difference then, and we can talk about Magnificent Seven and other tech stocks now, and whether there is an analogy. I mean, a lot of these companies were not profitable.
Mm-hmm.
They were concept, blue sky. We knew about the internet. We didn't really know how pervasive it would be in terms of people's lives. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely going to be the next big thing. And it was quite interesting because I think where there is a parallel, so valuation is a different thing because even the profitable companies were sitting on stratospheric multiples.
Cisco, and Microsoft.
Ah, some, right, okay. So Cisco is the case in point. So Cisco was the stock that everybody owned because we could not identify who the potential winners would be on this kind of fledgling industry. But, you know, if you bought the company that supplied the plumbing, they were, you know, supplying every company that wanted to aspire into online and internet-related businesses. And it was a little bit like, you know, don't buy, you know, if there's a gold rush, don't buy shares in mining companies, buy the company that makes picks and shovels. And so that's why everybody bought Cisco.
Yeah.
Now, Cisco went to a stratospheric multiple share price echoes that of NVIDIA over the last 3 or 4 years, up to like 400%. But we all owned it and it was profitable. So it was a bit of a no-brainer until it no longer had its competitive advantage. And it's still about 90% below its peak in 2000. So the I suppose the question is, a company like NVIDIA that clearly has a competitive advantage, probably for another couple of years, has until it no longer has.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also the kind of Nokia versus Apple type of thing.
Yeah.
You've got to be careful that it probably is fine for now, but even people like you know, AMD are saying, you know, we've developed a smarter chip.
Supply comes along
so,
to satisfy demand.
It's a question of when to get off the merry-go-round.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a chart of Cisco here. We might just get that, Alex, popped in the in the pack to show where you can see the stratospheric rise there in 2000. And you're right, it's still well below where it was.
Yeah, so NVIDIA, probably you could, well, you can't extrapolate it into the future, but you can probably map one over the other in terms of the...
Yeah, I've seen that before. It's pretty close.
Yeah. But, you know, now NVIDIA's grown into its multiple.
Yeah,
well, that's the amazing thing. I don't know what Cisco multiple was back then, but I'm presuming
200 times or something.
Yeah, so it is a different...
Because it was the only opportunity. It was the only stock to buy. Yeah, and it was the most crowded trade in the market. And, of course, we all forgot to sell it. So basically, from 2001 to 2003, when that absolutely blew up, you know, it was a complete nightmare. The corollary of that is, because I wasn't really a tech fan.
Were you still running US money at this point?
I was on the UK desk in the late, around 2000. And what I observed was everyone was selling old economy stocks and buying new economy stocks. I think at the time, there were 11 TMT stocks in the FTSE 100.
BT and Vodafone were the biggest two.
Yeah, but there were a whole load of stuff that never hadn't made a penny, and they were IPO'd, and they just went straight into the FTSE. So you knew, alarm bells. Yeah. It wasn't my specialism, but you just knew this is way, way beyond frothy.
Hmm.
But I remember between, I think 1998 and 2000, the Unilever share price fell by 2/3. They'd never had a profit warning, but it was just people were selling out of these old economy stocks and buying tech stocks. And it was the biggest buying opportunity in old economy stocks.
And the tobaccos.
And yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we're not seeing that to the same extent now, but you are. The older sectors are certainly trading on pretty big discounts, but not so extreme.
Mm-hmm. I suppose to now draw the comparison with, you know, tech stocks today and the particular Magnificent Seven, although I think Tesla's probably no longer a candidate. I mean, it's a different business and its dynamic is different. You know, they've decided to go, you know, to buy market share by cutting prices. Have they destroyed what was a prestige brand to discuss? But it's a different type of company. Even if it has tech capabilities, it's basically... Yeah.
Well, still a manufacturer, makes cars ultimately, which is an inherently low margin business.
Yeah, so, you know, let's focus on the others who, you know, very profitable businesses that generate a lot of free cash flow, and they can reinvest that cash flow and good returns on invested capital. I'm comfortable with that.
Mm.
The multiple is less important than how incrementally they get a return on their capital employed. And as long as they can demonstrate that, then I'm happy with that. And I think, you know, we know earnings is a residual, and you can come up with zero earnings like Amazon and look on a huge multiple. They could change the way they account, and it could be on 20 times. And
well, a few businesses have done that, haven't they, in the last few years? There's been a few sort of about turns.
It's, you know, what incremental value they get from every pound of invested capital. And how much free cash flow are they generating? And these businesses have almost become staples, haven't they? Because you know, they're interest rate insensitive. In fact, higher rates have helped them because they're getting
cash on the balance
sheet. So they're almost impervious to macro, as long as
this regulation monopoly power story.
That is always a risk. Interestingly, that's been around for at least a decade.
Yeah.
And
in the EU in particular.
Really, okay, the Apple fine
yesterday.
Actually, what is it, 0.5%?
Yeah, it's 0.5% of the stock. Google have been under the spotlight for a few years in Europe, but they've not really managed to pin them down at all. But is there a sort of, I guess, is there a risk that maybe a Trump administration, if that were to pass, or the US regulator to tighten up?
However, much as one may dislike Trump, he's savvy enough to know that he's not going to kibosh all his domestic giants.
These are national champions now, aren't they?
Yeah, so why would he,
They are in an IP battle with China.
Yes.
They're not going to destroy their national champions when they're in a technology war, really.
Correct. The other thing I find interesting, though, is what's going on with AI and, you know, you've got Elon Musk suing OpenAI, or is it Microsoft? I'm not sure.
Sam
because the and this is interesting, you've also got the Writers Guild in the US suing because they've used
their images.
You know, not just images. So you've got Getty Images, but you know, they've used copyrighted material for these large language models to learn from. So, you know, if you want to go into ChatGPT and say, I want to write this article in the style of John Grisham, how does it know how to write in the style of John Grisham? And so this is a genuine potential, you know, lawsuits are going to be flying left, right, and center. So those that own proprietary content, maybe like a Rolex, Mm. Could be in a good position.
Or like an investment management podcast series.
Well, indeed. So I find that interesting because there is this, I suppose, philosophical, that we're going slightly off piece, that what Elon Musk is saying is that the latest ChatGPT version that has yet to be released now has learning beyond the capability of humans. And we're now in the very dangerous point that if this is commercialized, then there is a real human conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And one wonders to what extent some of the progress here gets, you know, gummed up in lawsuits and things like that. I don't know. I mean, but I don't think this is dot-com bubble like 2000 to 2003. I think the concentration of some very, very large companies that are very profitable, that have the resources to develop new industries, I think is actually quite exciting.
It feels potentially, you know, not there, it feels a little bit more nifty-fifty to me, but not quite.
I think that's a handful of stocks analogy.
In the 70s, Coca-Cola, IBM, Eastman Kodak, McDonald's.
Yeah.
But they were all on 40, 45 times earnings, but they were all beneficiaries of consumerism and a trend. And those stocks, they didn't blow up, to be fair, they just went nowhere for 10 years, right? So if there's going to be if there's going to be a kind of recompense for these Magnificent Seven or whatever you want to call it, that would be seems more of a parallel to me than .com.
I remember in one of Terry Smith's letters that he said even if you bought the Nifty 50 at its peak and held them to today, you'd still have made
you'd still have done a right performance.
S&P, because they had you'd have to suffer a lot of pain
Of course.
The ensuing kind of 10 years, but eventually.
Well, I think what's interesting is those companies actually delivered double the earnings of the rest of the S&P, but the share prices went nowhere because they had to fill into their own multiples.
Exactly.
And that sort of leads me on quite neatly, actually, to obviously 1980 to 2000 was a golden period for equity investing. I mean, it's fair to say that 2000 to 2010 was one of the worst decades for equity investors ever, post-29.
Unbelievable.
Your £100 in 2000 was still £100 in 2010, and it had been to 50 twice along the way.
Yeah, and this was interesting because when I joined Scottish Life in 1982, my older colleagues had been through the 73.5 market, and the UK market fell 73% between 1973 and 1975. Mm-hmm. So they'd been through something like that. And for those who were aware of that but never lived through it, 2008-09 felt like what that must have felt to them in 73.5. And that was an interesting time as well, because we set up Cheviot in 2006.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And so we were just kind of getting established, and then 2008-09 Lehman's happened. Now, I have a fascinating anecdote about that. And again, it was a great learning experience, because my chairman at the time was Sir George Matheson, who had just retired from being chair of RBS. Mm. He was still a consultant with Banco Santander, so he was still involved in the banking sector. So after Lehman's, and then, you know, there was this kind of contagion effect in the banking sector. It was obviously under a lot of duress, but this was before the bailout started. Mm-hmm. So he came in and he said, look, I remember, and he's kind of Scottish accent. Oh, well, you know, this is just a liquidity crisis. You know, it's nothing more than that. As long as the authorities provide liquidity to the banking sector, it will be fine. No, it was a solvency crisis. Yeah. And this was the big mistake. Either the banks just didn't care, or they just didn't know. And whichever it was, they're culpable. But, you know, these MBSs, most of them were toxic. They were worthless. And that's the bit they didn't get, that they were carrying stuff on their balance sheet that was worthless. And so it was a solvency. And as a result, you know, we're a big position in RBS, which we hung on to. We sold everything else. But he said, oh, no, you shouldn't sell your Royal Bank of Scotland. It'll look embarrassing because I'm the chairman of your company. So, you know, there's a conflict of interest. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this.
Now. Well,
but, history now. Yeah, so that that was another lesson learned, that people you think should know inside out what's going on often don't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so
that is really interesting.
My anecdote from that, and I joined a startup wealth management business in 2008, the summer of 2008. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't great timing.
Yeah.
Getting clients over and assets.
Sure.
The day that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, Monday the 13th, I think it was, we had Anthony Bolton into our office.
Oh,
the
right.
Most esteemed UK fund manager there was. Yeah. Right. And you could hear a pin drop in the boardroom. I can picture this day because he was talking about what was going on and FTSE was down X hundred points.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, because he wasn't managing money at that point, he was a sort of a spokesman for Fidelity. And he sort of said, oh, do you know, I really miss days like this. I really wish I was managing money. And he said, HBOS today at £3.20 and Lloyd's, oh, I'll be tucking into some of those today. And he was genuine. Yeah. You could see that he just wanted to go and buy these things. Well, HBOS get taken over by Lloyd's and the share price ended up falling another 90%. Yeah. So, you know, to come back to your point, people who probably should know by their reputation,
These
big hitters just got, totally wrong.
Yeah. Other thing I, again, having a background in economics and having been taught by monetarists, the Chicago School, this old Milton Friedman and his, well, not, I wasn't taught by Milton Friedman, but one of his colleagues who was in secondment from Chicago Business School, was teaching economics at Harriet Watt. And so we were one of the last universities in the UK that was actually peddling this monetarist orthodoxy. And, you know, Thatcher bought into it as well. Now, when quantitative easing started as a response to the banking crisis, so obviously rates went to zero very quickly, well, not as quickly enough, but eventually they went to zero, and then the whole bond purchasing thing started. The cries of, you know, this is just going to generate hyperinflation. They must be mad.
Yeah.
And I kind of put my hand up and said, I don't think so. And kind of taken to task by that. And the reason was because what you had then was a credit bust. So money supply collapsed and the velocity of circulation collapsed. So you actually had a shrinking money supply, which if nothing was done to stem that, you would end up in depression. And this is one thing that Ben Bernanke sussed quite quickly, and he was the key architect of his big PhD thesis
was on
the
Great Depression
29 and the depression in the early 30s, and he recognized the symptoms of this. And so I always, we didn't have a big research team or anything, but you know, I did the morning meetings and I said, look, the analogy is think of a bucket full of water and somebody's punched a hole in the bottom of it, so the water's leaking out. You've got to keep topping it up, keep topping it up, and all it's doing, this pumping money into the system, is just keeping the wheels turning. It's not actually going to be inflationary, and it wasn't. If anything, it stopped deflation and depression. The difference with, we can come on to the post-COVID response, where we had the whole thing again. This is going to be inflationary because we'd already had a huge amount of fiscal stimulus plus monetary stimulus. And I think combination was roughly 35% of US GDP between March 2020 and December 2021. Unprecedented in modern history. Equivalent to the whole Marshall Plan to redevelop Europe post-Second World War in 18 months. And the reason it was likely to be inflationary was that you were fueling demand, you had supply constraints, and you were increasing the quantity of money and also the velocity of circulation, and it had to feed through. It had nowhere else to go, whether it was in asset prices or real goods prices.
Yeah.
And you know, the O-level economics, what is the definition of inflation? Too much money chasing too few goods. Mm. There was the perfect characterization. You had too much money chasing a constrained supply.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting response, but people shouldn't have been surprised that inflation went up. And when they were saying this is transitory, no, until that whole quantum of money washes through the system. And it's taken all this time.
Yeah.
And again, I always kind of say, when Duncan used to say, you know, US is going to be in recession because you can't go from 0 to 5 in a bit percent without breaking the economy. I kept saying, no, actually, because the huge quantity of support that is still washing through, companies have refinanced, household balance sheets are strong, you're writing checks to individuals, and they can't spend it fast enough. There's nothing to spend it on. Mm. That will support the economy for a while. So it's a very, very different set of circumstances. So with hindsight, QE was probably a mistake as a post-COVID response. A fiscal response, fine. You know, if you want to protect your workforce, if you want to help people...
Underwrite businesses from going
bust. Absolutely. Yeah. Support the economy because there are supply constraints on it. Fine, that's what fiscal stimulus is there to do. That's what government intervention is there to do. I still think the monetary response was unnecessary. And we wouldn't have had the rampant inflation that we had. But anyway, as I say, it's just interesting that there are two periods where the outcome of QE has been completely different, but not many people understood why. Anyway, that's by the by. So,
do you think there's enough? Do you think we've almost got through the danger point of those US recessionary pressures?
Yeah, I do. The economy is strong, but not too strong. The labor market is still pretty strong. It's weakening a little bit, but wage growth is abating a little bit. But wage growth is still sufficient to keep standards of living quite high. And I think it's a happy coincidence. I don't think anyone could have predicted we'd be where we are in terms of the US economy. But one of the reasons I've always been a big supporter of the US is it's a largely self-sufficient economy. They didn't have the huge spike in inflation caused by energy prices going up because they are self-sufficient in energy. They're actually the biggest producers of oil and gas in the world. Never mind OPEC, they are. The US is now. And, you know, they even export. So they were exporting LNG to Europe to help them out post-Russia, Ukraine. So this rather self-sufficiency of the US economy, it's also a huge internal market and has the deepest pools of capital. So this idea that the dollar is finished and the US economy's prevalence is over, not in my lifetime. No. And now that China's rolling over,
I think. What are your sort of thoughts? We talked a little bit about in the pod about, you know, kind of the peace dividend post-Cold War kind of rolling back, fracturing globalization, West versus East, Russia, Ukraine, obviously, but China, Taiwan, potential flashpoints. I mean, your sort of thoughts that, like, obviously, our lifetimes, James and I's lifetimes and investing in our investing careers has been a peace dividend. Are we going into an era that's a little bit more dangerous, do you think?
I think so, sadly. and a more unpredictable, and in a sense, it part of the consequences of global inequality.
Yeah,
I think if anything, COVID, the rich got richer. Those with assets are even better 100%. Off.
Yeah,
and you can find all sorts of data that said inequality is narrowing. I don't believe a word of it. The quantum of it is, or optically, that will continue to create social. Unrest globally. I think
populism in the last 10 years.
Populism, there will be more protectionism, there will be de-risking, call it de-risking that rather than de-globalization, but that is a phenomenon we've just got to learn to live with. And the world will faction into groupings, economic, political groupings.
I mean, we're even starting to feel it in the UK, aren't we, in terms of relative salaries and, you know, the growth that's been in the US, the sort of businesses that are listed in the UK, the opportunities, you know, the opportunity set of IPOs and secondaries just isn't here. And that's unbelievably frustrating.
It is. You can't. I don't really see that turning anytime soon, unless you direct capital. But that's almost like going back to the pre-1979
capital controls.
You basically just channel investment into the UK. And what worries me is actually, you know, everybody's pension fund is going to be given an allocation to, you know, high risk, unquoted businesses. Mm. That's the aspiration. Mm. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
I don't think it's a good thing either.
No. I don't think so. I think that should be a government lead thing.
Yeah.
You know, is not for unwitting, you know, retail investors to suddenly come the wrong end of a bad investment. And let's be honest, the government doesn't have a great track record in infrastructure projects any kind of project. So I'd be very, very worried about that.
What do you think's gone? What do you think's gone wrong with the UK?
I don't think anything in particular has gone wrong. I think there has been there doesn't seem to have been an environment where businesses really feel comfortable investing for the long term. And you know, obviously the run into Brexit and the subsequent path. I think companies are improving. They're beginning to live with the consequences of it, but we've had volatility in terms of, you know, government policy and U-turns. I think a shrinking pool of capital in the UK and a shrinking investor base, because let's be honest, the traditional investors in equities and startup capital are immunizing their pension liabilities, and they're not investing in the real economy. So I think that's a massive disincentive. So I just don't think that's a particularly healthy environment. So I'm not surprised. The other thing I think is we have a history of innovating and basically selling that IP
too soon.
And you know, a company like Arm, you know,
that's the one that got away, isn't it?
One that got away, and that's not a great environment to encourage businesses to invest. So I think that's an unfortunate thing. So I think it's a combination of government policy, or lack of consistent messaging, and tinkering with you know, tax breaks and things to encourage businesses to invest. But I think that the Brexit, I don't think, was handled, irrespective of what you feel aspirationally people that voted Leave wanted. And there are certain aspects that I have sympathy with, but I don't think it was handled in anything like the way it should have been done.
No.
We could have got a better deal. We could have got some kind of deal, some rapprochement that would have given us access to the largest market on our doorstep. And talk about shooting yourself in the foot. So I think we're kind of picking ourselves up, dusting ourselves down. And I think that's put us back, you know, at least a decade.
We're going to have to go in again, aren't we, and try and negotiate.
I just don't think that's going to be an offer. And certainly not in the terms we had. So I think that's not going to happen this generation, I'm afraid. We're just going to have to learn to live with it and see what kind of accommodation we can come to. And as for signing up free trade deals with other countries, well, have we got one with Australia? I think
doesn't move at
all. I mean, it's decimal points. It's nothing meaningful. Nothing meaningful. Then the biggest market on your doorstep, 400 million people, single currency. You know, I mean, seriously, you couldn't make it up.
No. What was your best investing decision?
My best investing decision.
Usually bought some Falkland oil and gas.
No, tactically, in terms of picking a stock or whatever, I mean, I there's nothing that particularly. I mean, I bought very early on Renishaw when it was when it was a small
good business.
Cap.
Yeah.
And I've just kept it ever since. I always thought by now Sir David McMurtry would have retired, and there was an opportunity that they were trying to sell the business, that they'll probably shuffle off and God knows what happens to it. But that again was I remember I bought into that in the early 80s because I think Warburgs were the brokers, and I went on a company visit. And the thing they made then was what was called a touch trigger probe. So you put it on the end of a machine tool. And so it was smart technology in the UK that was going into the most sophisticated machine tool companies in the world, which were based in Japan. I thought, well, there must be something about this. This is a company to back. So that's probably my best single investment. And tactically, And it goes back to the kind of Brexit thing. But just before, we were looking for a hedge against it all going wrong, because even the night before, the expectation was it would be vote Remain. And so I managed to persuade Duncan to put in an allocation to gold to our portfolios as an asset allocation decision, not on the basis that the gold price would go up, but sterling was sitting at 150. And you knew that a bad outcome, the pound would collapse, which it duly did. It went from 150 to 120. And so we made a huge windfall.
Okay.
So the gold price didn't move, but we made a big currency. So that was tactically probably my smartest recommendation, which we actually implemented. And then Jonathan would love to do it again.
I reckon the day after the referendum was one of the most kind of fulfilling days of my career. It's on my desk by six.
Right.
Because I've been watching the referendum and, you know, heard the news at 4 a.m. and it was kind of eerie calm around the place.
Yeah.
But, you know, did a bit of dealing that morning, phoned some clients, sent some emails out. Like, you know, genuinely, this is the sort of stuff that we live for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those sort of bad days. I mean, you know, along the way, we've had quite a lot of bad days, right? We've mentioned LehmanBrothers.com. There probably wasn't a specific day. Black Monday. You're sort of... how should investors think about those rough patches, and what sort of, I don't know, hints and tips and tricks, and what do they do? Just don't look and forget about it?
The graph tells it all. You know, 40 years peppered with calamities, and the trajectory is still pretty obvious. So
bottom left, top right.
Quite frankly, so I suppose we're probably drawing to the final thing. You know, you've got the active versus passive debate. You know, can you actually outperform markets? And this is interesting. I still think you can, because that philosophically, despite my faux pas day one,
it's like a dissertation.
Markets are efficient. Why are we wasting our time here? There's the door. I was only joking, honest. I think it's getting harder. Passives now have overtaken active in terms of proportion of money invested. So momentum is becoming a bigger driver of markets, because people are agnostic about stock prices. It's just direction if you're investing in a tracker. I think the way you make money, and it's always been the way I've looked at running money, is rather than focusing on trying to find the next winner, focus more on the things that you think are at risk, weeding out the things. And the reason active managers consistently underperform benchmarks is that the human nature is to back the underdog, the companies that are suffering, because you think they'll eventually recover.
Yeah, mean reversion.
And you don't own enough of the good stuff.
Yeah.
And you own too much of the things that you hope will recover. You may have suffered the big profit warning, in which case you should ask yourself, should I have seen that coming? Did I do enough work on the quality of this business, the competition, whatever? And I think the way you outperform is actually trying to avoid the big profit warning, because it could take years to recover from that. Because the dynamics of the market are not going to change. Passive is cheap. You get the market return. When you're hearing month in, month out that, you know, less than 20% of active managers are outperforming, but they're not doing it consistently. The same ones are not doing it every year for 10 years. And so you've either got to cherry pick your managers and hope that they are doing the best job they can for you, but you don't really have control over that. But, you know, there are some that are doing it. I'm not saying that's not a good plan, but when it comes to direct equity investment, where you've got slightly more control, I'd focus more time on things that potentially could damage my portfolio rather than trying to pick the next 10 bagger. But you should obviously try and identify good businesses, but I think probably spend more time on the things that could hurt.
I think, avoiding mistakes.
Avoiding mistakes
is definitely, and it's a sort of almost like a kind of negative mindset, isn't it? I'm just going to avoid being wrong. It doesn't feel like rather than I'm going to go and find something good.
And the reason you'll never consistently outperform the index, I hate to say it, is because there's a natural survivor bias in indices. You know, weak companies go bust, they disappear. And, you know, if you're owning them or they become smaller in the index. So if you're buying into a passive, you're buying that crap stock in a much smaller proportion than it was. Active managers will tend to load up on the assumption, rightly or wrongly, that eventually it will recover and they'll get more than their money back. And that, sadly, doesn't happen very often.
And then sort of allied to that, I mean, we have, as far as the demographic of the pod goes, we have quite a lot of sort of students, students, people coming into the industry. I mean, what would you sort of suggest other than don't buy the rubbish?
Well, if you want to succeed in this business, you have to have a natural curiosity about the world around you. You've got to behave like a sponge. You just really want to absorb lots of information. I don't mean financial market information. You just should have a curiosity about the world around you, because that will inform you about a lot of things that even on the day may not register, but it will make you a more rounded individual. And if you want to be a generalist, a portfolio manager, you need to know a lot. I don't buy into knowing a little about a lot of things as a dangerous thing. You're not trying to be a specialist, pretending you know a lot about stuff, but knowing a little bit, a lot of things gives you context.
Yeah, and it
avoids you becoming siloed and brainwashed and blind and all this kind of...
I think that's such an important...
But you have to be interested in, I don't know, anthropology. You've got to be interested in human behavior. Astronomy, prog rock. Anything... Just be interested, be curious. And as I say, that's... And genuinely want to learn.
Good questions is sort of allied to that, isn't
can't
it?
Be complete. And asking good questions, the old adage, there's no such thing as a stupid question, just a stupid answer. So never be afraid to ask. Never be afraid to say, sorry, I really didn't understand that. And that was one of the things one of my bosses taught me early on. He said, you go to lunch presentations, you feel a bit bamboozled by, you know, these very well-dressed, articulate people who think they know what they're talking about. If you don't understand what they're saying, just put your hand up and say, I'm sorry, could you just go through that again?
I think the most important thing with that is if you're asking that question, probably 80% of the room would quite like to ask the question.
They're so relieved you asked it on 100%. Their behalf.
And everyone nods and smiles and almost says, oh, thank goodness for that.
I know. And again, you just got to be a little bit kind of confident enough to not feel shy and retiring. What I think about markets now is that we've got proper price discovery. We've got, you know, a discount rate that is a real one and not a fictitious kind of zero, so you can see how capital should be allocated, and that gives better pricing across all asset classes.
Yeah, agreed.
And to me, that is the best opportunity we've seen in the last 10, 15 years, where everyone was kind of forced into equities because it really was about the only thing you could actually invest in with a growth potential.
It's been very liberating with clients.
As I say, the pain of getting there has been excruciating. Yeah. But if you're starting a new client with cash with a reasonable time horizon, 7 years plus, there's so much offerings and value in every asset class.
I think
it's a great time to start investing.
Agreed. And then what does the next stage look like for you then? What have you got planned?
So immediately I'm going to decompress for a little while, probably go off to Austria for a few weeks after Easter. I've got a novel to write. And I want to learn to play the piano. And then I'm probably going to think about doing something kind of more community-based. Just kind of... But my wife runs a charity, and so she gets a lot of involved in a lot of community projects. So I think I'd rather do something like that than become a consultant or an advisor to a charity investment committee, because it's just the same thing again. You know, what's the point?
Talking about the relative merits of the US against
the UK. I've spent 42 years pushing that particular barrel. I think it's about time to focus my energy elsewhere.
Thank you. Well, thank you on behalf of James and I and the pod for your time and
pleasure. It's been fun actually scratching back through my memory. As to all the big events. Amazed I'm still here.
Well, thank you on behalf of the firm for all of
Your guidance.
It's been invaluable, it really has been.
I'm delighted to have been part of it all.
It's been a pleasure working with you.
So. Thank you.
On that note, Alan, thank you. Any questions on any of what we've talked about today, get in touch. james.hughes@quartachievit.com. I'm jonathan.raymond@quartachievit.com. We hope you've enjoyed today, and we hope to see you soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.